Shift Drink by Joshua Bonsack. Ingredients: 1 1/2 ounce Rogue Pink Spruce Gin, 1 1/2 ounce Amaro or Bitter Liqueur, 1/2 ounce Sweet Vermouth, splash of cranberry juice, splash of anything weird that you have access to, why not? Preparation: mix together in rocks glass. Garnish with a wedge of some fruit, grapefruit maybe. The kitchen guys knew I was leaving the college town for New York and had started stealing beers from the walk-in cooler each night. One day, close to the inn, I cleaned the grime from behind the bar on a slow afternoon and found the bottle of Chinar in the well of bottles that we never used. I picked it up and smelled the contents. I remember the smell like the corner of my grandpa's barn where the nameless cats pissed and hid their kittens in the stack of hay bales. I poured my water out of my plastic kid's cup and into the dish sink and poured some Chinar in. I ducked to hide from the cooks. They liked to shoot the shit with me while I cleaned. That's how they made slow shifts go by faster. I had my own way. The Chinar wasn't bad, or at least not as bad as it smelled. It finished chalky, bitter, some sort of spice. I would have guessed cardamom, though I'm not quite sure what that tastes like. I stared at the bottle for a while and sloshed the liquid inside. It's one of the bottles that had been in the restaurant since before I worked there. It would have remained after I left if I hadn't started taking shots of it before my shift. I'll admit that, but it was the only thing that changed from the time I decided to move. I drank more on the clock. Everybody did it, and I always had, within reason. That being said, drinking some neglected bottle of Amaro wasn't going to set my boss back, but the kitchen guys taking bottles of Bud Heavy from the stock cooler started to add up. The moment the cooks announced the last call to the servers, Satchel, the sous chef, would turn off the grill and descend into the basement, only to come up 3.5 minutes later with 4 beers, one for each person in the kitchen. As bar manager, I had to call them out. My boss, a Brooklyn native who previously owned a restaurant named Mussolini, and once told me Hillary would have been more successful if he had the internet, would see the spike of Budweiser sales in my weekly liquor order and know something was up. Guys, you can't steal beer, I told them. I shouldn't have to say this. It's just our shift drinks, Satchel said. We've earned it. The kitchen guys all nodded as they scrubbed or mopped or saran wrapped. We don't do shift drinks here. It's not in my budget. Our head chef, Morgan, slicked back his shoulder-length curly hair from under his chef's hat. What do you care, man? You're about to leave here. You're so checked out. Morgan's beady eyes blinked too much, probably from the chemicals in the grill cleaner he had just used. I didn't know what checked out meant, and I still don't. I've thought about the term a lot, and I don't think it applies to anything I was doing. If I were checked out, I wouldn't care enough to ask them to stop stealing beer. Maybe it would have been better to have been checked out rather than the carrot at that point. I offered a compromise. I've been working on this drink with new liqueurs. I really like it. Instead of taking buds, I'll make you guys a cocktail, and you'll give me feedback. Osman packed up his knives and shook his head. Beer is easy. Easy, but expensive. Why did I care so much? Maybe it was the power of being a manager. Maybe it was my Midwestern farm boy sensibilities. Maybe I just wanted them to taste the strange drink I've been playing with. Morgan agreed it was best. Well, he said, aren't you going to make us a round? Haven't you already had your shifty? I didn't want him to get too drunk, or he'd get lazy about closing, and I'd get yelled at by our boss. Plus, he'd started to blow off his parole and go to freshman bars in town, where he was nearly twice as old as the usual patrons. I didn't want to see him while I was trying to relax after work. Morgan used to be a CNA at the university hospital, and a promising psychology student before that. He just couldn't manage to keep himself away from blow or harassing young girls with powerful lawyer fathers. I made them a round of my drink anyway. It's my take on a Negroni, I explained. Gin, vermouth, and a bit of this. I held up the bottle I had brought back to the kitchen and placed it on the convection oven. They all cheers while the customers sat in the bar waiting for me to bring their check. Osman said, "Mierda." Morgan grimaced. Satchel spit on the floor. Richard, whose real name I can't remember, but that's what we started calling him because it implied he was a dick, despite being a generally okay kid, didn't say anything, but just set his drink down on the prep table and kept closing the kitchen. And I said, "You guys don't mean that." I took a bottle from the oven, unscrewed the top, and smelled the barn from the bottle. Distinct memory of my Uncle Keith from the day he pulled me out of the creek. He was wearing this red and white striped stocking hat with a red puffball on the tip. I can almost see it bobbing as he laughed while I stripped my wet overalls on my grandma's kitchen floor. My mom's little brother was my favorite part about moving into my grandparents' house. My uncle was an accident, but then again, so was I. 5 years my senior and the closest thing I had to a brother. I had to leave all my friends at my old school in Chicago's Logan Square neighborhood, but was willing to be brave if it meant that I could get away from Rob and my mom would stop crying so much. When Rob locked us out of the house for the final time, we moved back to her parents' home. My grandparents were happy to have us. My grandpa picked me up and said, "Another farmhand." My grandma hugged my mom and asked her if she had seen Aaron Brockovich. My mom went back to school to get her master's. My baby sister got her own room, but I got to share with Uncle Keith, who seemed to understand her situation, despite being a teenager. Uncle Keith reassured me that my new school was great, and I would love fourth grade. He thought it was funny when I called him Uncle Keith instead of just Keith. He was always trying to make things seem light, and always on to convince everyone he was okay. He had a prosthetic left arm that he would take off like a magic trick. When I was young, I thought it was hilarious each time he'd pop it off and say, "Whoops." He gained the prosthesis after an auger accident while helping my grandpa grind feed for the cattle. Uncle Keith always kept in good spirits. He supposedly told the nurse at the time, "Good thing I'm right-handed." Uncle Keith was good with the animals, while they seemed to hate me. The chickens would peck at my feet when I brought them food. The sheep would buck me, and I didn't dare tempt the cattle. He'd laugh and push me towards the cow's gate. "Touch your nose, this son of a bitch loves it." And he put his baby steer in a headlock. It was post-New Year's, and we were due back at school any day now. While we lived at Rob's, I would be on his PlayStation all day until he came home from work. But Uncle Keith always convinced me to go outside. "Want to see the gilts? They're due any day now. They'll be huge." I liked the farrowing barn. It was warm and smelled like wildflowers, even during our winter break. "You're not gonna see shit like this in the city," he assured me. He was right. Once we entered that barn, things were different. There were some piglets crawling around the tired sows, and there were some piglets that weren't. I asked, "What are we gonna name them?" Uncle Keith shook his head. "God damn it, Dad said we had a few more days." I squatted down and reached my arm through the bars, trying to touch one of the piglets with my mittens, but only managing to pet the mama pig. I pointed at a lively one and asked him, "How about Rupert?" Then pointed to a less active one, and Ginger for this one. "We need to clear out the dead ones. I hate this part." He took off that red and white hat like he was defeated, and he told me, "I need you to go to the big barn and grab me some empty feed sacks." And then kept saying, "Goddamn, goddamn," while I retrieved the paper bags. I brought two back. "I'm gonna need a couple more than that, Jerry. There's four gilts here." He looked over them again. Four sows. So I gathered two more bags and helped Uncle Keith put the dead piglets from the last pig in the bag. I hated how squishy and unresponsive they were, and only gathered three of the 16 dead ones, while Uncle Keith cleaned up the other three stalls before putting the dead babies from the last one and putting them into the feed sack. I knew I was too old to cry about something so stupid, but I did. Uncle Keith patted me on the back with his prosthetic arm and asked me to grab some twine from the big barn. I took a long time getting it for him. I was trying to get all my crying out while petting the kittens that I could catch. A black one with white paws, or maybe a calico, I can't quite remember. When I finally came back with the twine, Uncle Keith asked for another favor. In the house, there's a box of matches in the drawer on the left of the desk. Can you grab them and some paper, any paper? I ran into the house. The new boots I got for Christmas didn't quite fit, but my grandma assured me that was a good thing. She told me, my parents survived the Depression. Anything that lasts is a good thing. In the quiet house, I rummaged through papers and envelopes with my mom's name on them, some with my dad's name, and a handwritten note from Rob. The adults were at work, and my little sister was at daycare, so I took a moment to appreciate what it meant to be alone. I found the matches, along with a deck of Uno cards, a Polaroid camera, and some scratch-and-sniff markers that I remember smelling like rotten fruit. I pocketed the matches and the papers with Rob's name on them. I thought I stalled for a while, but Uncle Keith had only managed to bring two of the four feed sacks down to the burn pile by the time I got back. Good timing, he said. Grab that last one, will ya? I followed him down the slight hill, dragging my sack to the ravine, where he threw his feed sack like a hammer throw. He asked, do you want me to get it? I can do it, Uncle Keith. I'm not a baby. I mirrored his throw, but didn't have the distance. The package broke open, and dead piglets came tumbling out. Uncle Keith shoveled them back into the bag and said, don't worry, buddy, I got ya. He launched the bag with his good arm, and it landed with a squash next to the pile. Satisfied, he said, paper? And I gave him the letters. He looked them over and laughed. Don't worry, you got rid of them. I think I'll just use this. He removed the letter from the envelope and handed the letter back to me. He crumbled the envelope in the base of the pile. Now give me those matches and paper, will ya? I passed him the matchbox with lettering declaring who to vote for in an election that had long since passed. He held the box with his teeth and with his good hand struck the match against the side. He cupped the flame with his prosthetic and tried to catch the fire to the feed sack to no avail. He tried again and again, but couldn't get a flame to light. Uncle Keith stretches back. Jerry, I need you to gather some tinder. Can you do that? I assured him that I could. It can't be wet. He pulled his hat down lower over his head. We're going to have ourselves an afternoon bonfire. I walked further into the woods until I reached a clearing. The water from the pond had stopped running in the cold. A 14-point buck trotted down the woods and met me head-on across the stream. I say 14-point, but I didn't find out what the point system was based on their horns until years later. I felt like I was in a Gary Paulsen novel. Like I could do this. Live in this world, on this world. I reached out my hand, and the buck didn't move. The buck chuffed, and a billow of breath escaped from his mouth. If I couldn't master those cows, I was surely more of an outdoorsman if I could subdue a wild deer. I took a step forward with my hand outstretched like I had something to offer him. The buck moved half a trot closer. I stepped again, and the ice creaked beneath me. The buck twitched his ear and ran away. Come back, I yelled after him, and stepped forward over the ice, which immediately caved and vaulted me head first. I remember the cold, the aching cold, and I remember the pull at my chest, though Uncle Keith said he pulled me by the ankle. And I remember the creek looking infinite there under the surface of the ice. But last time I walked by it a few years ago, the creek was 3 feet deep, tops. Then I remember crying and being carried, and my grandma coming home from her salon and pulling out that Polaroid camera to take a picture of Uncle Keith laughing as I took off my soaked overalls. But I can't remember that moment right, because I remember Uncle Keith's face laughing, as well as my own bawling. Logically, I can't remember my own face, but I remember seeing that Polaroid, I remember carrying that picture in my breast pocket when I was a pallbearer at Uncle Keith's funeral when I was in high school. I remember being angry because I had to carry a coffin of nothing. His body was pulverized after a semi's grill devoured his motorcycle. I remember crying, and I remember laughing over the irony that he would throttle and shift the bike with no problem, but his prosthetic couldn't operate the horn, and that's what got him, if he was even sober enough to honk in those days. I remember him being so happy. About my shift drink cocktail until years later, when I had tried to make it at a New Year's party I went to with Sophia, my new at the time girlfriend. Her cousin in Chicago invited us to stay with her and her husband while they had people over. I didn't tell my mom or sister and her family that I was in the Midwest from New York, because I had seen them a month before during Thanksgiving and I didn't want to intrude again. Sophia told me her cousin lived in Logan Square because it was the hip place to be, which wasn't how I remembered it. She said, "We can take the L downtown during the day and check out museums, and take it back tonight to eat somewhere good around here." We got up early and started walking in the wrong direction to the train stop, then through a balmy park. We corrected ourselves when I said, "You know, I lived around here when I was a kid." Sophia craned her neck at me through the hood of her winter jacket. "You said you grew up on a farm." We moved to the farm when I was in fourth grade. Before that, we lived somewhere in this neighborhood. We waited for the light to change at an intersection. I'm not quite sure where, though. You should ask your mom. "No, I don't want to bother her." Sophia looked a little disappointed, so I said, "I remember the school, though. Darwin Elementary. We used to watch cars tear down the one-way from the classroom windows." Sophia looked it up on her phone. "We're only like a block away. We have to go." I said, "It's weird to go out of your way to walk by a grade school." But we turned down the street anyway. We reached the school and leaned on the barricade that divided the street to a roundabout. Sophia smacked her lips. "I thought you said this was a one-way." "I could have swore it was." "Should we go find your old house?" "Rob's house." "No, I don't think so." There was no way he could still afford to live there, if he was even still alive. Or was he richer than I remembered? He did own a PlayStation. "We should probably get going before the museum gets too crowded." Sophia looped her arm around mine as we walked away from the two-way street. Sophia's cousin's husband, the host of the party, said, "I'm going to pour you a shot, and you're going to hate it." Then he handed me a novelty shot glass from a Hard Rock Cafe with pale yellow liquid in it. I took a sniff and recognized it instantly. He eagerly watched me as I threw the shot back without hesitation. I smiled as the familiar chalky taste covered my tongue and flooded my mind with images of the bar. "That's the most confident Malort face I've ever seen." A bit confused, I assured him, "I go way back with this one." "Oh yeah, what do you think of it?" He started mixing a drink for himself. His form was sloppy. He added too much vermouth in his scotch. He'd never worked behind a bar. Maybe never worked a day in the service industry at all. "I love Chinar," I told him. "I used to make a drink with it at this bar I managed in college." He scoffed and took a sip from his unintentional Rob Roy. "That's not Chinar. You're drinking Malort. It's a Chicago delicacy." He handed me the bottle. He was right. The bottle bore Jepson's family crest, not the artichoke label I was expecting. This was a cheaply made bottle with a plastic screw top, not unlike a well vodka. But I remember the taste so vividly being associated with the turn of a red metal cap. He asked me if I could still make the drink from my college bar. I felt my face flush. You wouldn't like it, I told him. Nobody likes it but me. He said, try me. If I wanted to make the drink, I could have texted Morgan or Osman or asked if they remember the recipe, but I wasn't even sure if their numbers were their numbers anymore. I could have made the drink from memory, add a little gin, a little vermouth, a splash of Peychaud's bitters, just for a reaction from these people I had just met, or worse, to watch everyone pretend they love it. As the room spun, I just said, maybe another time. I made my way towards their guest bedroom, where I pulled the old Polaroid of me and Uncle Keith from the pages of the book I was reading on the plane, then held my head in my hands as someone shouted, 15 minutes until midnight, everybody.